All right. Hey, everybody. Thanks, John. Appreciate it. You're welcome to change the vibe anytime. Yeah, so Mike, the question, we're in the middle of a series called The Great Questions, and you have been sending me the great questions, which are questions that occur to you and that you think might be of value to wrestle with, and I'm compiling quite a list, so I'm just also throwing out another opportunity. Send me an email, kdobson@westmichigan.org. I don't even know my email address. And it's also really good just to hear from so many of you and what's kind of stirring around in there. It feels, in that sense, it feels more like a conversation. And send me what occurs to you. And I'm going to get to some big ones. In a couple weeks, I want to talk about one that just keeps coming up is something about, is there a God? So don't worry, we'll solve that just in a couple weeks. All I got to do is come on a Sunday and CNN and Fox News, and they'll all be here, and finally it'll be settled. So I will wrestle with, I think, some of those perennial questions, and this one really comes from David White, and also is in the background of a few things that you sent me. It's in the background. And the question is, what can I live wholeheartedly? What can I live wholeheartedly? And maybe the subtitle here, it's not a subtitle, but I probably should have put it in parentheses, in the age of anxiety. What can I live wholeheartedly in the age of anxiety? And I want to talk a little bit about what I'm calling the age of anxiety. Now, I'm not really making a historical claim. I don't know. I wasn't around during the Black Plague. Could have been bad. I don't know how people carried themselves. What I would like to say is that many people feel anxious, and our culture kind of feels anxious. And I'm going to define what I mean by that, by anxiety. Not that you have to agree with my definition, but just so that we're more or less on the same page. It's certainly normalized. It's normalized, and in some ways, it's promoted by our cultural voices and institutions. And so, I'd like to suggest it's at least in the water. It's in the water, and I could also give you a lot of very dark statistics about the rise of things like depression, anxiety, and stress, and PTSD, and suicide, and human rights, and food production, and inflation, and wars, and stealing of data, and species loss, and let's not forget about lies and misinformation, and climate challenges, and right and left stuckness, and scapegoating, and blame, and violence. Just to list a few things that make us feel anxious. So if you don't feel anxious, if you didn't feel anxious when you walked in, now you do. but you already know this. You already know this. It's part of what people talk about, really. I think, and we all carry a kind of what I would call a low-level dis-ease about something or about someone or about the state of affairs, a low-level dis-ease. Sometimes a low-level dis-ease about a group. And sometimes we just can't even name it exactly. And this gets me a little closer to how I would like to use anxiety today. And again, I'm not asking you to, you know, agree with my definition. I'm not speaking clinically here. But the way I'm using it now, I'd like to say that anxiety is much more like a sort of dis-ease or discomfort, the cause of which is not obvious. It's not direct. It's more indirect. I mean, when you feel anxious, well, here's the difference. When you feel afraid, like if I drop you in the water and there's a big fin of a great white in front of you, you know, circling you, you don't think, what's the meaning of life? You know, it's not like an existential crisis. That's direct fear. What's the cause of it? There's a great white circling you. That's the cause of it. And you feel dis-ease, but you can name it more directly. So the way I'm using anxiety now and what I'm calling the age of anxiety is that it's more low level and it's indirect and we're not sure exactly what the cause is. In fact, maybe we could say if anxiety is like a stream here. There are really hundreds of tributaries, and it's hard to see them all. And you're not exactly sure. And take something like, here's just an example. How many of you feel some discomfort about climate challenges or climate change? How many feel some discomfort? Yeah. Well, what exactly, what specific thing? Like, what would you say? Oh, it's sea level rise. Well, what can you personally do about it? How does it happen? When is it going to happen? Don't live on the coasts. You know, like, what are you supposed to do with something like that? It's so big and so massive that a certain amount of uncertainty and ambiguity comes with it, and we feel the discomfort. But it's not, the causal relationship is more ambiguous. Does that make sense? And now just extrapolate that out into just about everything else, and that's why I'm calling it the age of anxiety. So the way I'm using it today is that it's some dis-ease. And I think among the dis-ease, also good things happen. I mean, discomfort isn't necessarily a problem. I mean, okay, so we're uncomfortable with things. It's like, I signed up for a marathon. I've never run a marathon before. And I mean, I used to do triathlons and stuff like that, but I've never just run a pure marathon. And I've never even run that far, really. And so I ran kind of a long ways yesterday, and it was uncomfortable, you know? I felt dis-ease, we could say. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because I would like to improve, you know? So in any case, discomfort, dis-ease can, you know, certain questions might arise. And questions like this. I'm not sure what's important. I'm just thinking about the age of anxiety here. I'm not sure what's important. That's probably a thought or at least a feeling that you've experienced over the last couple of years, over the last couple of months. I'm not sure what's important. I'm not sure who is right, other than I know that I'm right. No, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm right about any given thing. So I'm just saying the age of anxiety can bring up questions like this. And how about what is safe? Is it safe? Is it safe to go about my daily life? Who can I trust? Is there anyone I can trust anymore? Besides our elected officials? Is there anyone I can trust? And, you know, maybe there's the question just beneath that, and it's something like, I'm not sure what my values are. I'm not sure how to live them, or I'm not sure what's really in my heart. And these are small doors, I think, to deeper questions. They're important doors. So just because we feel anxious about things doesn't mean it might not raise really important questions like, what's important to me? What do I value? What do I love? What's worth working for? Is it safe? Who can I trust? What does it mean to be trustworthy? Am I a trustworthy person? What's in my heart? These kinds of things. But our cultural institutions, I think, in the age of anxiety, don't really want to open those doors. But it's like, instead, if anxiety is a bit like a fire, our cultural institutions and voices and media outlets just constantly throw gasoline on the fire. That's one thing. Just and watch it flame up. Like, I'm afraid. Don't worry. Watch the news. You'll not be afraid. You know, it's quite the opposite. You know, it's like, and it fans it. And on the other hand, in the age of anxiety, so we fan the flames on the one hand. On the other hand, we offer ways to alleviate that, because you don't want to constantly live in this state of stress. And what are ways to alleviate that? Well, you can probably think of, I don't know, many ways of alleviating things that people or institutions or voices or corporations offer just a little taste to alleviate the anxiety. I always thought it was funny that, it's not funny, it's kind of dark, but when COVID started, that alcohol sales started skyrocketing. Why? Because people were looking for a temporary alleviation of the anxiety. Wouldn't you agree? And shortly thereafter, weed was legalized, and, you know, here we go. So a temporary alleviation. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this. I'm just saying it's an impulse. Consumerism works the same way. How do I alleviate my anxiety about climate change? Buy a Tesla. Really? It's a temporary alleviation. You don't want to look too deeply into how these things are made and what their actual effect is on the environment and so forth and so on. It's a temporary alleviation. And it's almost easier if it comes in a package of some sort, because you can buy it. It's concrete. And it does help for a moment. I promise you, if I drove a Tesla, I would feel morally superior to all of you. I would. I would just be like, I don't know. I just don't know about the rest of these people, but I am really righteous. At least for a while, I'd feel that way. So, and our culture is really set up that way. Yes, it's the age of anxiety, but all these other kinds of pills and things to buy and so forth and so on step in for the temporary alleviation. And we could add to that even certain joining a certain group, having a certain identity, some sort of group identity does help alleviate the anxiety. It does. It's like, well, I don't know what's important anymore, but my group does. And certainly we know that we're better than other groups, so there's that. And again, our whole culture is really is seeking to alleviate some of this anxiety by offering various kinds of identities. Groups, group identity. And that's not nothing. That's something. How many of you remember middle school? It's the same thing. It's like all those hormones are there, and it's a bit confusing. I didn't love middle school. I like went through a phase where I had to wear bifocals in the sixth grade. I paid the trombone, which was too heavy for me to carry. And it was a very awkward time. Plus, I had a southern accent. I moved here when I was in the sixth grade. That doesn't work so well in Michigan. I mean, the Michigan accent is really strange, at least to me. But I stopped, you know. People thought I was really polite. I wasn't. I was a very rude kid. But because I said yes, ma'am, and yes, sir, you know, at first, you know, the teachers thought this is the greatest kid ever. Until I was in the classroom for 30 minutes. Anyway, middle school is a challenging time. But middle school is also the time where you start wondering, what group am I in? What music is the cool music? What clothes do I wear? And it's this us versus them mentality, and it's an important part of growing up. Actually, if you never experience a little bit of group belonging, you're in serious trouble. You know, there is a kind of arrested development. If you never find a group that says, hey, you belong, it's important. So our culture is offering this all the time, saying, you belong in this group or that group or this political group or that party or this ideology or this consumer group that chops at these kinds of places and not those kind of places. All pretty important. The lovely thing about middle school is it's great for middle school. It's perfect for adolescence. We've just extended that out into the rest of adulthood, really. So the hope is something like this, that we find a good enough in-group so that we can outgrow it. Or maybe it's that we find a good enough sense of identity so that we can outgrow it. And I'd like to even suggest that a healthy spirituality helps us loosen our attachment to these kind of middle school identity games. Helps loosen a healthy spiritual practice or community. I mean, one thing that we ought to think about just as C3, are we finding ways of, first of all, saying it's important to find a group that you belong to, but also are we finding ways to say that's not our only source of identity and loosening some attachment to that. Someone who has a loose attachment to their identity, to an identity group, you can actually have a conversation with, really. So, like Rilke has this great line, I've quoted it here many times, but he says, if we would only let ourselves be dominated as things do by some immense storm, we would grow strong and not need names. I'm going to say it again. If we could only let ourselves be dominated as things do by some immense storm, like think about a maple tree clinging to the side of a sand dune on the shore of Lake Michigan. So if we could only, in a storm, if we could only let ourselves be dominated as things do by some immense storm, think about the immense storm, then Rilke says, we would grow strong and not need names. That little line right there, not need names, there's a kind of spiritual depth there. Like, in other words, he's saying you're rooted in something deeper than just passing identities or what you buy and consume and the clothes you wear and all that kind of crap. All right. So here's what I'd like to suggest. Sorry. That one way to alleviate or a kind of antidote for cultural anxiety is courage. Okay, this is my premise today, is courage. You can already feel the difference. I don't even have to define exactly what I mean by things. Just right at the beginning, just feel into what does it feel like in my own body, in my own way of being, in my own presence, when I'm feeling courageous and when I'm feeling anxious. You know, you can feel the tension there, the dichotomy. And I'd like to suggest that a certain amount of courage, I think, is needed in the age of anxiety. We don't need necessarily more people just dumping gasoline on the fires or promising temporary, you know, alleviations that don't work, or groups saying, as long as you join us, the world is right and everyone else is wrong. We know we don't need more of that. But I think we might need some more courage. And by courage, Beth was reminding us in the pre-talk thing that courage comes from a French word, which means heart. We need more heart in the world. Or something like what I'm calling wholeheartedness. Wholeheartedness. And so the question is something like this: what can I live wholeheartedly? No, really, like, what can I live wholeheartedly? Like, really, I'm going to live in a full-hearted, courageous way. Is there anything? What can I live wholeheartedly? I am going to wholeheartedly buy a Tesla. You know? Like, seriously, think about it. What can I live wholeheartedly? I mean, really from a deeper source, from a kind of rootedness. And who's asking questions like this? So this question, this line of thinking, of course, was inspired by this David White quote, which I'm going to read in a minute, about courage and about some other things I got from him. So credit where credit is due. And anyway, he tells this story about when he was a young man working for a nonprofit. And it was like a nonprofit that was trying to save the world, like all nonprofits. and nonprofits are important. It's also hard to work for a nonprofit because the world doesn't always want to be saved, you know? And the world doesn't always want to be saved by you and whatever your nonprofit causes are or ideas are. So it's challenging, and it leads to burnout and, you know, sadness and depression and anxiety and stress. And not only are you stressed that we're saving the world and it's not happening quickly enough, you're also stressed about finances because you're dependent on, you know, people's financial donations, and there are boxes available in the back and so forth. That's what it's like, and it can be a kind of a stressful place to be. And he was talking about that, living like that as a young man, and he was really involved in what he thought was the right cause. And sometimes you get involved with things like this. But why would you be involved with the right cause and coming home every day and feeling out of sorts? Something's not in alignment, wouldn't you agree? Something needs to be paid attention to. So that's what he was experiencing. So he came home one day, and the story goes, and he remembered that his friend, a Benedictine monk, was coming over for dinner, and he was excited about this. And his monk friend came over, and the first thing he said to his Benedictine friend was, "Speak to me of exhaustion." Now, first of all, who talks like this? You know, well, apparently David White. I mean, what a way to start a dinner party. Speak to me of exhaustion. Talk about wanting to really get to the heart of the matter. He was saying, "I'm exhausted. What's wrong with me? What do you know about exhaustion? How can you speak to me from your wisdom tradition of And when was Saint Benedict? Fifth century, I think. Here you are, part of a tradition that's 1,500 years old. Do you know anything that can help me? And his Benedictine friend said this. He said, you know, the antidote for exhaustion is not necessarily rest. Seems like it would be. You know, that's like the McDonald's version. Was it McDonald's? You deserve a break today. Was that McDonald's? Yeah, you deserve a break today. Nothing says break like toxic foods, you know? I'm just kidding. I go to McDonald's every once in a while. I know you. I a minute ago I was morally superior, and now you're morally superior. Yeah, so you deserve a break today. We think that's it. I'm exhausted, a vacation. I don't know when the last time you went on vacation was, but it's kind of a stressful thing, you know? last year I went to Yellowstone, and it was amazing. It was, and the Tetons, and I went, and my kids went, and my brother-in-law and sister-in-law went, and my oldest daughter's boyfriend went, and it was basically like the most work I've ever done, you know, just to try to make it happen. This year I planned a trip to Glacier. I was supposed to leave on Friday. And I just said, ah, forget it. Let's just go up north. So that's what we're going to do. So anyway, the antidote, I still haven't gotten to the story yet. The antidote for exhaustion isn't necessarily rest. He said the antidote for exhaustion is to live wholeheartedly. The antidote for exhaustion is to live wholeheartedly. I think about that also with what I'm saying about anxiety. What's the antidote? I don't know. And I'm not trying to give clinical advice. If you're feeling anxious, get some help, really. And a lot of help is available. So I'm not minimizing that. But I'm also saying it's an important question. What can I live wholeheartedly? What can I give my heart to? Who can I give my heart to? How can I live in that sort of way? You know, like, wearing your heart on your sleeve. You know what's uncomfortable about that is that you're out in the open. You know, it's a vulnerable way of living in the world. It's also a wholehearted way of living in the world. And anyway, so his friend said to him, the antidote for exhaustion is to live wholeheartedly, and your problem is that what you're doing right now, you're not living wholeheartedly. Your heart is rooted in poetry, and until you turn in this direction, you're always going to feel like this. Now, what a thing to hear. You know, first of all, the difference between working for a nonprofit and being a poet, I mean, you're already poor if you work for a nonprofit most of the time, but you're going to choose poetry? I mean, that's not a career path. Thanks, monk. Your meals are paid for, you know? Anyway, but it changed his life, though. It changed his life just to even wonder about the question, what can I live wholeheartedly? What's already in there? That's functioning like a compass that I'm not paying attention to. And that can be true of any time you get involved in any kind of cause, if it's, you know, even if it's the right and righteous one. Sometimes your heart isn't aligned in that way, and it's hard to listen on that level to find that out. So I want to give you the exact line because I think it's powerful. This is what the monk said to him. You're exhausted because your real conversation with life is through poetry. Which leads to some questions. What is your real conversation? Like, what is the conversation you're born to have in the world? And by conversation, I don't just mean the one that you're having out loud. Like, the conversation of your life. How are you oriented? How do you show up in the world? What are your wounds and talents and gifts and makeup and disposition? I mean, on the heart level, not the ones that corporations and your family dynamics have forced you into and all that kind of stuff. I mean, really, like on the heart level here, what conversation are you born to have with the world? And to have it, I'm saying, is to have a courageous life, to live from the heart space. Um, I thought about on the way, on the drive over this morning, I don't know why this image popped into my head, but I was thinking about living from the heart. Like, I was trying to think of, like, what's an example of somebody that does that? What's an example of somebody that's, by their very essence, having a conversation with the world? And for some reason, the first person I thought of was St. Francis, not someone I ever met. I was like, oh, St. Francis. And he came onto the scene, and I won't give you the whole history of St. Francis, but he comes onto the scene during the time period of the Crusades. You should know that. So, like, when you think about the darkest chapters of church history, the Crusades is one of them. Wouldn't you agree? Hey, let's get together and kill Muslims and Jews. And when we get to the East, we can't tell the difference between Orthodox Christians and Muslims, so we'll just kill them too. Dark, okay? Dark chapter. Sorry, I got a little fired up about the Crusades there. St. Francis comes onto the scene at the same time. Talk about Christianity being complex and interesting. You know, here's someone who said, I'm just going to wear a brown robe and no shoes, and I'm trying to live like Jesus. And so, given the anxiety of his age, he decided he was going to go to the battlefront to see if he could bring some peace. He said, as far as I can tell from the Gospels, Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, so why are we doing this? And he walked to North Africa. Well, he didn't walk across the ocean, but he walked south in Italy, took a boat, and went to where the battle was happening, and he asked to see the Sultan. Now think about that. Think about it in light of a word like courage, because sometimes we use courage and we think acts of bravery, like let's put on the battle armor and go in. He goes into the war, but he doesn't have anything. He doesn't even wear any shoes, and the Sultan says, well, come on over and let's have a talk. Well, what should we talk about? And he's like, well, I'll just talk to him about Jesus. And turns out the Sultan knows about Jesus. Why? Because he's a Muslim. And so they had this little conversation about what do you know about Jesus and what do you know about Jesus, and they go back and forth. And there's no dramatic end like, and then the Sultan became a Franciscan. No, that wasn't the point. The point was he was embodying a certain way of being in the world and doing it courageously from the heart. And I imagine that life wasn't the same for the Sultan, and life wasn't the same for St. Francis in some way. And think how vulnerable that is. Would you do that? See, that's, what can you live wholeheartedly? Well, I don't know. For him, it was like, well, I'm going to go and talk to him about peace and see what I can do. Did it end the Crusades? It didn't. Did it probably put a question mark in them? It did, actually. Put a major question mark. And what? Why are we doing this? What are we up to here? So here are questions I think can get us close to the question of what can I live wholeheartedly? What is your real conversation? In other words, what do you really care about? What are you ultimately for? That came up really last week when I was talking about hate and hatred. It's an interesting question. What are you for? What do you love? Like, what do you love? How are you uniquely oriented in the world? What things do you really love? Like, if you turned off your phone for a month, and also in the news outlets, and also for some random reason, the conversations that you had didn't involve people telling you about the urgent thing that's happening, that you have to care about, what would you actually care about? Do you feel what I'm saying? When we're so inundated, if that was silenced, what would come out of the heart is the question. And to live like this, I think, is to be courageous. Now, I think I can get to this reading from David White. I want you to look at it. Courage is the measure of our heartfelt participation with life. It's about participating in the world in a certain way. Courage is the measure of our heartfelt participation with life, with another, with a community, with a work, with a future. To be courageous is not necessarily to go anywhere or do anything. except to make conscious those things we already feel deeply. Like, what do you already feel deeply? That's what he's saying. What do you already feel deeply and honestly and authentically? And to bring consciousness to that. To make conscious what those things we already feel deeply, and then to live through the unending vulnerabilities of those consequences. First of all, I wish I could write like this. I want to read this whole sentence again. To be courageous is not necessarily to go anywhere or do anything except to make conscious those things we already feel deeply, and then to live through the unending vulnerabilities of those consequences. He's saying, all right, I'm encouraging you to live with heart. And that's going to require of you to be more vulnerable. And that's uncomfortable, but it's uncomfortable in a different way than anxiety is uncomfortable. There's a kind of rootedness, a heart rootedness that's present. It's hard to show up vulnerably in the world, wouldn't you agree? I would rather post nasty things online. That's easier. I think of them constantly. I'm not on Twitter. I would be banned from Twitter if I was, the things that pop into my mind. But that's easy. That's not unending vulnerabilities, really. It's a challenging question. What does that look like for me to show up in a heartfelt way? Hey, this is where I'm coming from. This is who I am. This is what I love. This is what I care about. These are the things that keep me up at night. You know, that's like showing up with no shoes on. You know, that's like St. Francis showing up with no shoes on. Here's the final little part of this quotation. To be courageous is to stay close to the way we are made. See, there's good news. You don't really have to do anything other than stay true to the way you're made. Now, that's not always easy to find out. And there are a lot of people telling you to be a certain way. I realize that. But to be courageous is to stay close to the way we are made. And I think we learn about this slowly. My suggestion is to find out, or to stay with, if you already know, what makes your heart bloom or sing, and to live from this place. Even when I think about that, I can feel like I wish the world had more people in it who were living from a place, even though it's a metaphor, I realize, where their heart was blooming and singing. That seems to make that you would think that would make a difference. The song of your life, you know? Now, when would you do this? I mean it in the most ordinary times, like when you're like a parent or a grandparent or a son or a daughter or a spouse or a neighbor. This kind of heartfelt, wholehearted living, I think, is a kind of antidote for the age of anxiety. And who can do it? Anybody. You can do it. Find out that you don't need names, like identity markers, like Rilke says. Find out. Live from that place. Be courageous and heartfelt. Camus has this great line. He says, I'd like to live quietly to the point of tears. You know? I don't even know what he means by that, but I do know what he means by that. Like, yeah, I want to live with that kind of vulnerability to the world. I don't, most of the time, do not live up to that. I'm telling you that right now. But to do so is to live courageously. And I think our world needs people like you who are more courageous and are stepping forward in that way. I think about the Sultan who was making a career out of warfare. I think about just being greeted by like a man in rags and bare feet. I just love this image. And to show up that vulnerably, it's very hard to deny, really. It's very hard to say, get out of here. I can't talk to you when somebody shows up in a vulnerable way. And I'm saying we need more of that in the age of anxiety. Thanks for listening.